Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller. Find your next obsession. Or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
It's Thursday, December 29th, 2022. I'm Jackson Bird. Today, our final look back on some of the best segments from the past few years. From 2021, how beer making used to be considered women's work, and also may have popularized some of the popular symbols like broomsticks and pointed hats that we associate with witches today. Plus, why the CIA covertly funded the British cartoon adaptation of Animal Farm in the 1950s. And as 2022 comes to a close, a look back on one man's predictions for this year, written from his perspective in 1922. Here's some cool stuff for your ride home. So on the February 23rd episode of this show, I talked about how the stereotype of brewing and beer culture is heavily weighted towards white men. But in fact, there's a long history of black brewers in America and in many African cultures. And now I'd like to further demystify the white guy associations by talking about how beer brewing used to be considered a more womanly task in some cultures, up until about the 1500s, when some men didn't like how successful the women brewers were getting, similar to the history of black brewers being pushed out, only in this case, the men accused the women of being witches. The whole witch trial thing, while often associated with Salem, Massachusetts and 1692, actually went on for about three centuries, from the mid-1400s to the mid-1700s, and spanned throughout Europe and the Americas. Beer drinking, meanwhile, started long before that. Quoting Professor Lakin Brooks in The Conversation, "From the Stone Age to the 1700s, ale, and later beer, was a household staple for most families in England and other parts of Europe. The drink was an inexpensive way to consume and preserve grains. For the working class, beer provided an important source of nutrients, full of carbohydrates and proteins. Because the beverage was such a common part of the average person's diet, fermenting was, for many women, one of their normal household tasks. Some enterprising women took this household skill to the marketplace and began selling beer. Widows or unmarried women used their fermentation prowess to earn some extra money, while married women partnered with their husbands to run their beer business." End quote. Brooks says women from cultures as disparate as the Vikings and the Egyptians brewed beer. One of the more badass saints, in my opinion, Hildegard von Bingen, is even the first known person to write about using hops in her beer recipe, although she didn't love it, saying that they, quoting the Washington Post, "induce melancholy and weigh down one's insides," end quote. And the Mary Sue points to a ton of goddesses across cultures who were associated with beer making. Quote, "Ninkasi was the goddess of beer and beer making all the way back in ancient Sumeria. She now lends her name to Oregon's Ninkasi Brewing. In southern Africa, Mbaba Mwana Weresa was a goddess of fertility, agriculture, rainbows, and beer. And for the Egyptians, beer was foundational to their lives, and so they had a goddess for that too, who was also associated with magic, darkness, health, and protection, Isis's sister, Nephthys. In Europe, the association of powerful goddesses with ale-making abounds. One is Brigid, the Irish goddess of fire, smithing, poets, healing, and more, who was also associated with beer-making. And her Christian form, Saint Brigid, is a patron of brewing. And there are so many more. Gabjwajwa in Lithuania, Minna in Germany, Albina in Wales, and on, end quote. And as far as those mortal women in the Middle Ages and Renaissance who took to selling their beer at markets, often referred to as alewives, they could usually be found selling the beer from large cauldrons, with cats on hand to keep mice away from the grains, an ale stick, usually a broom, propped up against the stall as a sign that fresh beer was ready or used to flag down customers, and sporting big pointy hats so that customers could spot them in the crowded markets. So these women in tall pointed hats were bubbling up potions in a cauldron with their cat and broomstick beside them. The story goes that in the 1500s, as the Reformation was beginning, large-scale commercial breweries, mostly run by men, were starting to ramp up, making use of newer emerging technologies. Brewing was starting to become a real profession, which meant that women and their cottage industry home brewing were naturally getting pushed out. But that slow-moving exclusion wasn't enough for some men. They wanted a quicker, more active way to push women out of brewing, so they began to tarnish their reputations. Some focused on the product, quoting Vice, according to Judith Bennett, the preeminent historian of women brewers in this period of England's history, both the public and the male-dominated brewing industry accused brewsters of diluting or adulterating their ale with cheaper brews, and thus of cheating customers. Brewsters were also accused of selling tainted ales that could make drinkers sick, perhaps intentionally, end quote. But taking advantage of the religious frenzy and associated stricter gender norms burgeoning under Reformation, some also accused women, either out of convenience or honest zealotry, of practicing witchcraft. Their cauldrons and extensive knowledge of herbs obviously being markers of brewing magic potions, and the beer just a cover. Now, all of this definitely happened to varying extents, but what's less clear is to what extent some of the imagery of alewives that we associate now with witches was actually common enough among alewives to draw that connection. For example, the pointed hat being worn by alewives selling their beer at markets so they could be identified in a crowd is just one of several possible origins for that pointy witch's hat. Others include the anti-Semitic Jewish hat that Jewish people were forced to wear by the Catholic Church in the 1200s. This then led to the hat being associated with all sorts of heretical and satanic behavior. In America, the hat does somehow seem to flow from anti-Quaker sentiment, even though Quakers didn't wear pointed hats, but they did devoutly keep their hair covered, which was something the Puritans used to prosecute them for. And long before any of that, the witches of Subeshi from around the 1st century used to wear black funnel-shaped felt hats. There are so many other possible origins, some conflations all influencing each other in turn, like a similar hat being a common part of English country attire that seemed strange to snobbish city dwellers. Or Scottish philosopher John Dunce, who literally believed in a fairly common metaphorical association with conical hats as rising your intellect through the tall hat above that of ordinary people. John Dunce is, of course, who we get the dunce cap from. Kind of came back to bite him in the butt there. But in general, tall conical hats were long associated with sorcery, advanced thinking, the esoteric, and getting closer to higher powers. But whether it was the alewives with their pointed hats and cauldrons, cats, and broomsticks being accused of witchcraft for continuing a centuries-long tradition of women, which led us to associate all of those symbols with our contemporary stereotype of witches or not, quoting Vice, one fact remains eerily, spookily true, that in history, the domestic work of women has often been devalued and erased by men who came to dominate the industries that were built on those skills, especially any skill that was important in the kitchen. And that, dear readers, is something that sends a chill down our spines and is a spell we'd like to break. End quote.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
So last Wednesday, I mentioned that Andy Serkis is directing a new cartoon adaptation of George Orwell's Animal Farm, and I casually slipped into that announcement how the existing 1954 cartoon adaptation, which many of us may have watched in classrooms growing up, was covertly funded by the CIA as anti-communist propaganda. So let's dig into that a little bit more. Now, first of note, this was the first feature-length animated film in Britain, and every single voice was done by just one performer, Maurice Denham. It was also originally rated X by the British Film Board because they thought it wasn't appropriate for anyone younger than 18. And in a true measure of shifting sensibilities, the film now has a U rating for Universal, or all ages. But on to the very interesting part, how the CIA came to fund this cartoon. Written by a British author in the midst of World War II, the original Animal Farm book had nothing to do with America. The satirical allegory was, according to Orwell, reflective of the events leading up to the Russian Revolution of 1917 and the Stalinist era of the Soviet Union. But at the same time Orwell was putting the finishing touches on the book, what he would later call his first true effort to fuse politics and art, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency was busy forming the Office of Policy Coordination, or OPC, a covert wing of the agency focused on psychological warfare, or as The Guardian put it in a 2003 article, quote, creating culture as a secret weapon to combat communism around the world. End quote. And quoting further from that piece, which largely pulls from Francis Stoner Saunders' book, The Cultural Cold War, The CIA and the World of Arts and Letters, quote, the Cultural Cold War began in post-war Europe, with the fraying of the wartime alliance between Washington and Moscow. Officials in the West believed they had to counter Soviet propaganda and undermine the wide sympathy for communism in France and Italy. The CIA recognized from the beginning that it could not openly sponsor artists and intellectuals in Europe because there was so much anti-American feeling there. Instead, it decided to woo intellectuals out of the Soviet orbit by secretly promoting a non-communist left of democratic socialists disillusioned with Moscow. Ms. Stoner Saunders describes how the CIA cleverly skimmed hundreds of millions of dollars from the Marshall Plan to finance its activities, funneling the money through fake philanthropies it created or real ones like the Ford Foundation. End quote. So Animal Farm was just one of many dalliances. And once the CIA had decided on adapting the story of Animal Farm into a feature-length animation, they called on their Hollywood undercover agent, Joseph Alsop, and a seemingly none the wiser Los Angeles writer named Phineas Farr. The two were dispatched to England to negotiate with the recently widowed Sonia Orwell for the rights to her late husband's novel. And to butter her up, a CIA official secretly made arrangements for her to meet her hero, Clark Gable. Having been successfully courted by Gable, Orwell gave Alsop and Farr her blessing to adapt Animal Farm, and production began. Allegedly unbeknownst to most people involved with the film, CIA officer Howard Hunt was in charge of the whole operation. Hunt would later be convicted as one of the members of the Watergate break-in team. But back in 1951, he was busy recruiting Louis de Rochemont to produce Animal Farm. De Rochemont had made a name for himself as the creator of the newsreel/commentary series The March of Time. Now, for such a pro-American film, how did it end up getting made in Britain? Well, production costs were lower, for a start, but more importantly, some historians suggest that de Rochemont, or the CIA, may not have trusted American animators. Several in the industry had been questioned during the House Un-American Activities Committee hearings, including Walt Disney himself, although he was mostly there to accuse his former employees, particularly those who had tried to unionize, not because he was suspected of communism himself. But many animators and others in Hollywood were blacklisted as a result of the targeted witch hunt, which ended up leading to the jailing of the infamous Hollywood 10. With so much suspicion of Hollywood animators, it was seen as a safer bet to hire their British counterparts. Or it could have just been the various connections de Rochemont and others had with screenwriters and producers in England. In the end, 80 people worked on the film for a period of 3 years. The scripts, written by married couple John Hollis and Joy Batchelor, went through many revisions throughout production, so it's unknown who ultimately made the decision to alter the film's ending, though blame is often placed retroactively on the CIA. So rather than the book's ending in which the farm animals can no longer tell the difference between the human farmers and the tyrannical pigs, in the animated film, the humans are absent at the end and the farm animals trample the pigs to death. Death, emerging triumphant. While some disagreed with the change from Orwell's more nuanced philosophical ending, others at the time saw it as more upbeat, you know, one of the many infusions of optimism or lightness that experts say were necessary for the film to be able to compete with Disney's animated movies. The movie didn't do too well when it was released. It actually took 15 years to earn back its budget, but it went on to become a staple in classrooms, not just in the UK and the US, but around the world. But the CIA didn't stop there. They also adapted 1984, 2 years later, and also changed the ending of that one. Quoting the New York Times, in the book, the protagonist Winston Smith is entirely defeated by the nightmarish totalitarian regime. In the very last line, Orwell writes of Winston, "He loved Big Brother." In the movie, Winston and his lover Julia are gunned down after Winston defiantly shouts, "Down with Big Brother." Such changes came from the agency's obsession with snuffing out a notion then popular among many European intellectuals, that the East and West were morally equivalent. But instead of illustrating the differences between the two competing systems by taking the high road, the agency justified its covert activities by referring to the unethical tactics of the Soviets. End quote. Like Animal Farm, this 1956 adaptation of 1984 didn't have a stellar reception at the time. In its case, it went on to be largely overshadowed by the Michael Radford adaptation actually made in 1984. But both represent this strange ripple of time when the CIA poured huge amounts of money and time into creating culture as a secret weapon. It's interesting to think about within the context of our current digital and political landscape, especially looking at some of the ways Russia has been manipulating social media through bots, influencers, and state-sponsored media in recent months. You know, I wonder what departments there currently are in the CIA covertly fighting back against those efforts again, ones which we may not be made aware of for decades to come. Retrofuturism is one of my favorite trends, especially mid-20th century speculations on what the future will be like, or new technologies and interior design choices that were made to be evocative of the future as they imagined it. You know, basically all of the Jetsons. But it's also fascinating to go back even further and see what people even more removed from our present time thought might have happened by now. And often these predictions are just as off-base as some of the retrofuturist-style flying cars and domestic robots of the Jetsons. But a 1922 piece in the New York Herald that was recently re-upped on Y Combinator's Hacker News boards proves that sometimes predictions about the future can be surprisingly measured, pragmatic, and therefore quite prescient. Written by columnist W.L. George on May 7th, 1922, and preserved by the U.S. Library of Congress, the piece, What the World Will Be Like in 100 Years, does have a few ideas that are a little off base, but often combined with ones that are really on point. He predicts wireless telephones and the erasure of power lines, so yes and no. He says coal and oil reserves will be seriously depleted, and we will probably get energy from the tide, the sun, and radium. Again, yes and no. He predicts commercial flying will be entirely commonplace, and that America and Europe may be separated by only about 8 hours. Now, that is a particularly impressive calculation in my book, considering I could get from my house in New York City to London in just under 6 hours right now. He's definitely got some weird ideas about domestic servants that definitely show his class at the time, and also seems to think that most home furnishings will become disposable. But he was at least right that with less coal power, homes and buildings will be much cleaner. And George also has the very common retro-futurist prediction that meals will be taken in some sort of pill form, although he's not wrong in saying that synthetic foods would be more common, and that indulgences like a hot meal and some pie would still be eaten in full, just supplemented with a pill for lunch. And, you know, if you replace pill with a protein bar or shake, he's actually spot on. One of his more off-base predictions is a glass-roofed-in city that, quote, completely does away with weather, end quote. He's also got some ideas about people living predominantly in giant community buildings, that family ties would be weaker, and that kids would be completely taken over by the state. And though it sounds preposterous at first, it's worth remembering that 1922 was a time when child labor laws were still scarce, and a lot of our modern norms like compulsory K-12 education and school lunches would seem a bit odd to George. I did find his commentary on war to be interesting. He thinks there will still be wars, of course, but perhaps they will be less frequent than in his times. Quote, "I suspect that those wars to come will be made horrible beyond my conception by new poison gases, inextinguishable flames, and lightproof smoke clouds. In those wars, the airplane bomb will seem as out of date as is today the hatchet. War may ultimately disappear, but this lies beyond the limits of this article, and even beyond those of my mind," end quote. As one commenter from Hacker News pointed out, what makes George so successful in many of his theories is the recognition that technology will change, but human nature will remain the same. As George says himself, quote, "The world at that time would be remarkable to one of our ghosts, not so much because it was so different, as because it was so similar," end quote. George also had the sense that the scale of scientific innovation from his time to now in 2022 would not be nearly so impressive as from 1822 to 1922, saying, quote, "President Jefferson knew nothing of railroads, telegraphs, telephones, automobiles, aeroplanes, gramophones, movies, radium. He did not even know hot and cold bathrooms," end quote. And I think that may be a true point. I mean, it is mind-blowing to think that many people lived to see us go from the Wright brothers' first flight to men walking on the moon, to say nothing of the atomic bomb and later innovations like the web and smartphones. But even all of that, it felt like there was precedent for by the early 20th century, whereas the rapid industrialization of the world throughout the 19th century more so set the stage for all of those precursors to our modern tech. I mean, I don't know, the argument could be made either way, really, and the reactions to the article on that point are certainly mixed. And it is true that the more specific George tries to get, the more he misses the mark. He lowballs the 2022 U.S. population by about 100 million, for example. Still, other commenters were particularly impressed by George's awareness of and sensitivity to women's issues, with one commenter even speculating the columnist was a woman, with the initials WL concealing her gender. That's not true. WL stood for Walter Lionel George, but Mr. George was hired by the Herald to write short daily essays on women's issues, being described as, quote, "long a feminist sympathetic with the aspirations of women, but withal one of their most earnest critics," end quote. And here are some of George's predictions for women in 2022, quote, "It is practically certain that in 2022, nearly all women will have discarded the idea that they are primarily makers of men. Most fit women will then be following an individual career. 2022 will probably see a large number of women in Congress, a great many on the judicial bench, many in civil service posts, and perhaps some in the president's cabinet. But it is unlikely that women will have achieved equality with men. Cautious feminists such as myself realize that things go slowly and that a brief 100 years will not wipe out the effects on women of 30,000 years of slavery," end quote. Interesting choice of words at the end there. Another commenter from Hacker News pointed out how of what George got right, a lot of it was already in place by the 1960s, saying, quote, "When we think about the distant future, we simply think about tomorrow," end quote. And I think George's predictions about movies are a great example of his thinking merely of tomorrow and not so much the long term. In 1922, Hollywood was just a few years away from transitioning from silent films to talkies, and only a few more years away from feature-length Technicolor movies. Yet George's predictions don't go far beyond predicting that movies will be in their natural color and that actresses will have to know how to talk. And funnily, he predicts that this will precipitate the end of stage performances. And honestly, looking at it from his perspective, I'm actually more impressed that it didn't. But for all of his swings and misses, I do like how George thinks about the future generally. He concluded, quote, "It is not my business to congratulate the future, as it is impossible to say a thing is good or bad. All one can say is that it exists. The world takes care of itself. It has been doing so for hundreds of centuries and is still spinning. The world will take care of itself in 2022. That is its chief occupation. The future will be difficult. What does that matter? So was the past difficult. Difficulties did not prevent its turning into a tolerable present." End quote. And as we ruminate on our own futures, I thought I'd end with this poem that someone in the comments shared. It's by Mary A. Ford and is called 100 Years From Now. O mighty human brotherhood, why fiercely war and strive, while God's great world has ample space for everything alive? Broad fields uncultured and unclaimed are waiting for the plow of progress that shall make them bloom 100 years from now. Why should we try so earnestly in life's short, narrow span, on golden stairs to climb so high above our brother man? Why blindly at an earthly shrine and slavish homage bow? Our gold will rust, ourselves be dust, 100 years from now. Why prize so much the world's applause? Why dread so much its blame? A fleeting echo is its voice of censure or of fame. The praise that thrills the heart, the scorn that dies with shame the brow, will be long-forgotten dream 100 years from now. O patient hearts that meekly bear your weary load of wrong, O earnest hearts that bravely dare and striving grow more strong, press on till perfect peace is won, you'll never dream of how you struggled o'er life's thorny road 100 years from now. Grand, lofty souls who live and toil that freedom, right, and truth alone may rule the universe, for you is endless youth. When mid the blessed with God you rest, the grateful land shall bow above your clay in reverent love 100 years from now. All right, well, that is it for this week and for our end-of-year Best Of specials. We're taking another long weekend for the holiday, so I will be back in your ear holes on Tuesday the 3rd with all new episodes for the all new year. And before I go, I just want to thank you all so much for listening to this show. Whether you listen every single day, actually on your ride home from work or school, or you just pop in every couple of weeks and marathon the latest episodes, however you listen to the show, it means a ton to me that you do. I absolutely love crafting this show every single weekday. It is an absolute joy to spend my days just learning cool new things and having a community that I get to share that with. So a big thanks to each and every one of you. I hope you all have a safe and happy New Year's this weekend. And that's going to be it for me for this year. This show was produced by Ride Home Media. I'm Jackson Bird, and I'll talk to you again in 2023.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, it doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first 3 audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcast FREE.